Well, I've heard a lot of things like this in real life that didn't go quite to this extreme. And I matched up some of my personal experiences about mass movements and mass leaders. I felt that the documentary did us a great service. I wish there were more things like this, where the real sounds of events would come in an undistilled fashion with an intelligent commentary setting up a historical perspective to help us figure out some of these things. And I responded at a personal level as one who works with people who are in trouble a variety of ways in a community where I've lived for many years and who are always looking and searching for something which is secure and more absolute than I myself can ever give them. I'm always under pressure to be more absolute, to offer more concrete solutions, and sometimes I feel guilty that I don't. And so I heard all of those kinds of things coming back at me. Here was someone who certainly did succeed in that area, and in a sense it helped me verify the fact that there are ambiguities in the world which need to be born rather than go after the absolutes. It just kind of helped me clear up my own head about that one. It's a chilling and a very atrocious way to be reminded about that.
Okay, Jonas Levinsky, what were some of your impressions?
Well, I had a number of them, and I found myself responding in a very clinical way when I started to pick up on the pathology that I saw.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of transfixed me for a while. And I found myself thinking along the lines of what happens to people who get involved in a cult? Why was it that they were following him to this extreme? When did he begin his descent? And started looking for parallels that we see in everyday life that are not as extraordinary, but would be examples of the same mental mechanisms that go on. And tying that in with a theological approach of healthy versus unhealthy religion, what's the difference, and tying it all together from that viewpoint. It was very compelling. And unfortunately, because it was so sensational, I think that many people overlook it as an aberration and not look for similar threads that are in society today and in our own lives.
Well, this is a theme that I think we're going to be continuing to discuss over the next hour. I've selected a few excerpts from the tape for rebroadcast at this time just to refresh our listeners' memories who heard it last night and to perhaps provide an introduction for those of you who missed the program. And I've really selected very unextraordinary parts of this in a lot of ways. It's not the parts where you can completely dissociate yourself and say, wow, this fellow is really mad. I've never heard a laugh as unhuman as this before. And there is, in fact, a couple of sections in which his laugh sounds so much like an animal's howl.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, these are as far as what we heard last night, fairly unextraordinary segments, but I think they will provide some very interesting subjects to talk about. So let's hear this first excerpt. And this is taking place after there's been a lot of testimony about loyalty to Jim Jones, and we're going to hear a woman who is one of his followers who also testifies to her loyalty to him and to her willingness to die, and then leads all the followers in a song. Okay, as those of you who have tape machines at home know that what you just heard is tape run backwards, so we will be fixing up those technical difficulties in a moment.
Maybe it sounds better that way.
maybe it's even more instructive. Now, well, while we're waiting for that segment, is there a place in what you heard last night that hit you most personally, you know, that really seemed to you like something you'd heard before or that some just kind of hit home, not so much as a professional but as an individual?
One phrase that came back several times that he said, which just seemed a very simple one, but it kept banging on my head, is life has no meaning other than principle. And here he's got people in this environment in which everything is absolutely determined, and yet he's saying life has no meaning other than principle. And I hear that in so many different ways every day, people living according to platitudes, abstracts, and principles. Mm-hmm. That connected with me as being one of the most dangerous connection points with what I would call religious distortion, a distortion of what is most creative in religion.
Okay, let's listen to this taped excerpt now. And once again, this is after an evening of like testimonials, people talking about how they're willing to support Jones and willing to die if he says so.
Yes, I think we all should die tonight if it's our turn. I'm willing, Father, to stand with you all the way, just like I always have told you 3 years ago. Everything seems and will always be the same. I'm not changing.
You don't need to say. You don't need to say no more. I remember
know.
Your fight.
I love you, Father.
I know you do.
I know some of my people that others go. I felt like they're gonna hate you. When they hate you, you hate me.
That's right.
I tell you the truth. I'm not gonna lie. Mm-hmm. You're the only father I have. You're the only family I have.
Sorry,
I give up my brother.
I remember you fighting.
To you. You.
I remember when you sang. I never heard him. Sing it for us right now.
I'm gonna sing it for you.
Hey,
all the days of my life, ever since I've been born, I never heard a man speak like this man before. I never heard a man speak like this man before. All the days of my life, ever since I've been born, I never heard a man speak like this man before.
Come on, sing. Never heard a man speak like this man before. The days of my life ever since I've been born. Never heard a man like this
man before.
That's true. Wherever in the hell it's brought us, it brought us on principle, it brought us on courage, and it brought us to the right place. And if we hold on, we'll make it. I never heard a man speak like this man before. I never heard a man speak like this man before. All the days of my life, ever since I've been born, I never. Louder, louder. Clap your hands. I never. I never heard a man speak like this man before. All the days of this life, ever since I've been born, I never heard a man speak like this man before. Now make your sound move. If by any chance you would make a mistake to try to come in and take any one of us, we will not let you. You will die. You will have to take anybody over all of our dead bodies.
That was an excerpt of one of the tapes. Broadcast initially last night on the National Public Radio documentary on Jim Jones, and the tape was recorded by Jones himself. Well, one of the things that we heard there was the use of a church kind of music, of a gospel kind of music, to sing the praises not of God but of Jim Jones. And we heard Jim Jones leading everyone in song, singing his own praise. What went through your mind hearing that, Ralph?
Well, I felt that it had a adulation of self quality to it, drawing all people to himself. It certainly, that is a perfect example of what I think all the tapes have in common, all the tapes made of the mass rally stuff, I don't think we ever hear the word God.
No,
maybe Jesus a couple of times, but it sounds like it was even built, and so he's on a throne-like arrangement. And so it seems to me it's just whipping up people into a frenzy, focused constantly on him as the center, the magnet for the energy.
Yeah. This is exactly what happens in the group dynamics. The people are identifying with him. It's almost as if they're becoming part of him. As we were talking while the tape was on, it was almost like a pep rally. And I think anyone in the audience who has attended whipped up pep rally, whether it's for a football team or for patriotism, experiences that rush of oneness, of identification with the leader. And this is precisely, I feel, what was going on there. And in Ralph's point of all the adulation onto himself, increasing the dependency. And these people, particularly those who came to him with perhaps some low self-esteem and not much identity, were able to identify with him. So that further on down the line, which I'm sure we'll get to later in the broadcast, the question of you can't possibly turn against him because that's not acceptable, because you've already made him part of yourself.
Do you think that the followers could have had the same kind of spiritual uplifted feeling singing that song, being led in that song, as they would in a conventional church, in a regular church or in a synagogue, where the singing of a song can be a very,
sure,
emotional experience?
Yes, except that here it was such a contained situation, and that's one of the things about cults in general, is it's a very circumscribed. And so all they had was each other and him. At the end of the hour, the service wasn't going to be over. So it became more and more important to participate in that.
It's also clear that anybody who kind of gets out of line is subject to instantaneous public ridicule, brought right up to the front and chastised in front of the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing there that pertains to any of the aspects of what I call traditional worship. Jewish, Christian, even black worship.
There was no respect for the individual.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's get to the next excerpt, and this will give an example of how Jones sounded when he was preaching or doing one of his sermons to the community of Jonestown.
Just remember, nothing worse than putting somebody in the corner when they've tried over and over and over to do righteousness and no one receive it. And you get them in a corner, they're extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous, aren't they? And I think you can sense the hands of these people, that we are nonviolent people, but we're extremely dangerous. Because we've been fed up with anarchy and fed up with rebellion and fed up with selfishness. Just remember, you don't have anything on me that I care about, because everything that you have on me, I've let it all hang right out for everybody to see. Now you get to worry about yourself. I don't mind losing my life. What about you? I don't mind losing my reputation. What about you? I don't mind being tortured. What about you? I'm just no longer afraid, and I've lost interest in this old world of capitalist sin and racism. I've lost interest in it. So if somebody wants to make me stay in it by compromising with filthy-minded people that cannot even have respect for somebody that would die for even his enemies, and they want to cause anarchy in our midst, I would just as soon bring it all to a glorious screaming end. Just bring it to a screeching stop in one glorious moment of triumph. So you think about it.
Another excerpt of the tapes recorded by Jim Jones at Jonestown and broadcast through the National Public Radio documentary that we heard last night and that we're excerpting today. It's some rap that he has. He's a very powerful speaker,
extremely
and obviously
persuasive,
can draw
and
people in.
Extremely persuasive, and certainly putting down the seeds for what happens later on. He's emptying himself before the people. I can give up everything. They've already identified with him. Okay, he's appealing to the dark side of their nature by saying that even though we're gentle people, really very dangerous. Frequently, as we see with more of a swing conservatism today in the country, appealing to that darker side. People are fed up and tired. And he's laying the seed for I think, for his own death and for the death of his followers. It's there. You can argue out how long it takes, but I think it's there.
Yeah, it sounds so familiar. It sounds like a parallel to Christ or a parallel to any other of the martyrs or suffering servants. That while, once again, he never, in any of the tapes we hear in this documentary, even quotes scripture, nor does he really suggest any connection with anything of doctrine. Nonetheless, he's kind of personifying the suffering servant.
He's paralleling Paul, you know, in some of his stuff.
And yet, I'll be darned if, as I listen through that thing, if I can see that there is cogent content to it.
It's what you were saying before about...
It doesn't connect with anything which is really a part of a life experience, except insofar as the life experience of these people now has been totally confined to this commune now for a number of months in the jungle, monopoly of all information, all feedback, all rigor, and everything has been determined from the top. But, you know, that's where we would say we connect in terms of our everyday experience with some of these same things, in terms of creative, relational experiences with the real world in which we live, which makes talking about Jesus or Paul or martyrs something which is a creative, positive connection point, which helps us identify with our own sense of setback, suffering, and coming through it to some new purpose. But within this situation, it is used as kind of a motivational push to get people kind of pushed closer and closer into the corner where there is no out for them except then what I'm convinced as Julian is he is determined is going to be the mass suicide all along.
Yeah, and the seeds of what I see as paranoia are starting to become apparent in that. We against them, you know. They're coming to get us, and if they do, we'll be ready. This delusional system, is starting to build up. And last night's tape, of course, it got really to a pitch.
Let's hear one final excerpt, and then we'll open up the telephones. And the question with cults is always: are the people in it brainwashed? Are there indoctrination techniques? And what is that process like? And Jones, from the documentary last night, I learned, had like news tests in which he'd quiz people about principles and about events in the news. And this is an excerpt in which you can hear how that testing went.
Okay. What was the basic premise of Mao? Young man, you already passed. What was the basic premise of Mao? Mao Tse-Tung said there's only one way a revolution can come. Do you know, Millie? Oh, hold it now. How did Mao Tse-Tung say the only way you can bring a revolution and keep it?
Well, the only way I think you can keep it by being peace and being alma.
Oh, shit, being at peace. Mao Tse-Tung said that?
No.
He's the head of China. He's the head of the revolution of China. He marched 6,000 people on the line. He's been on a long march.
I had my mind on something there.
Okay, then what did he say? There's only one way you can bring about a revolution for the people.
Only way you can bring it on is by killing.
Well, that's okay. I'm going to let you pass on. But what did he say? He had a nice little phrase that everybody should know. Change only comes, look, a lot of seniors got it. Change comes through?
Through by a barrel of gun.
That's right, senior. And that's good. Because you, by rights, would have every reason to forget something. Change must come through the barrel of a gun, said Mao Zedong. This place would be a paradise tomorrow if every department had a supervisor with a submachine gun. There'd be no shit here, right? Everybody'd work, we wouldn't have no trouble. But that's a shame. Because we have the right to do certain things. The government's suggesting we get armed, so we will be able to enforce our laws. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, dear. You passed.
Another excerpt from the Jim Jones tapes initially aired in the NPR documentary last night. I must say, part of that sounded really familiar to me. I recognized, as weird as it was, I recognized that as a teaching process that I had experienced something similar to. I mean, he went beyond the line, but I have to say that I had one or two teachers that weren't very unlike the way the process he was using to teach.
Sure.
And that the confusion in the woman who obviously had no idea what to say,
yes,
and was just trying to figure out the right thing, I recognized that confusion. I heard it throughout my school years.
Sure.
What do you think of that method of teaching? Is that what we mean by indoctrination? Is that brainwashing?
Well, what it's done is it keeps people off guard. They become much more dependent on him than they ordinarily would be because he has the answer and they have to think it up. And they don't even know if they have the right answer half the time. So it's up to him. He's got all the power there, and he can reinforce them as he wishes. He can chastise them. He can humiliate them. He can praise them. So once again, it increases their dependency with him and the tremendous identity with him as he has all the answers. He's dad, which gets us into the whole thing of parenthood.
Sure. I'd say a lot of educational experiences we have, public schools, certainly in some parochial school formats, I would imagine, although I didn't go to parochial school. Julian was the expert in that field, I think. Other situations, though, in households where parents are trying to get things across, that same kind of pressure gets put on kids. And I think that any of us who has children and wants to help the children learn certain things find ourselves coming to the edge of some of these points where if we go beyond them, then we are violating the children and abusing the children. So that's a parenting role. Of course, they all call him daddy. He's got them in a parent-child relationship all the way through.
That's right, and they trust him.
Okay, let me reintroduce you, and then we'll open up the telephones. I'm with Dr. Julian Slavinsky, who is a psychologist and was a monk in the 1960s, and was and is a theologian, and also Reverend Ralph Moore, who's an Episcopalian minister and director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus. We invite you to call with your questions and your comments about the Jim Jones tapes, and particularly if you have questions for my guests, we'd love to hear from you, and our number is 923-2774. And again, that's 923-2774. Ralph, what are some of the basic principles that you would suggest for differentiating between a charlatan or a madman and an inspired religious leader? Because there's some things that they have in common, like a really good rap, the ability to inspire people and to inspire them to the point of following them, and to just create an atmosphere, to really a high-energy atmosphere.
I can only pass on to you what I just learned not long ago from a guest we had in a group on the campus that was working along some of these lines. And I'm really indebted to him for having boiled it down to two points. After all the confusion, I think I agree with his guideposts. He said the difference between a charlatan and a false teacher and what we would call a dependable guru or a teacher or a leader whom we could trust would be on two counts. Number one, the real teacher refers himself or herself back to a former teacher and is somehow in lineage with a tradition and is saying, I am merely a vehicle to bring this into another interpretation or another manifestation or another view.
He's humble.
So there's a humility to the past. The second is that the real teacher does not try to create any illusion of teaching anything new. That the real basis of learning and coming to truth that we late 20th century are exploring, is the same as 2,000 years ago in terms of human life coming in touch with ultimate reality. So a teacher today says, merely all I'm doing is trying to tell you what my teacher told me. It's nothing new about it. And if there's anything that makes sense to you about this, I'm awfully grateful that that's happening.
Sure.
And I think those are very trustworthy guideposts for what real teachers are.
Yeah, I would like to break the dichotomy down into two as well. And one is in terms of healthy religion versus neurotic or unhealthy religion. And one is authoritarian versus a humanitarian approach. The authoritarian religion is one that stresses guilt and obedience and gets people all upset. and as opposed to the humanitarian one, which sees fault in a loving sort of way, as there's a way to improve, ends up with a good feeling about self, which we can call good mental health, versus an authoritarian approach, which ends up people feeling guilty and not liking themselves because they're so bad.
Then I have to ask, because everyone's saying, how come the people, when they realized that Jones was a charlatan and an authoritarian and a madman, that they didn't get up and leave? And then you think about the amount of strength of will and physical strength that it would take to have actually left.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ask myself, well, what about, for instance, and you may think this is an unfair comparison, you can let me know, what about, for instance, a woman in the Roman Catholic Church who is not supposed to be using birth control or not supposed to be getting a divorce or not supposed to have an mm-hmm. abortion, and who says, no, I want this or I need this, and I think maybe my leaders are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It takes...
There's no question that there must be an awful lot of terror there.
Yes, there is, but on the other hand, she's got a lot of support. If right. she reads the newspapers or talks to her friends, they realize that the clergy are in the minority in this respect, although people's conscience can be pretty severe.
Is the Pope authoritarian?
Well, the teaching is. It's when you're told that my will is God's will, insofar as history and tradition is concerned, that's pretty tough to argue with. And that can inspire an awful lot of guilt in people. It doesn't lead to as open-minded approach as one might like. And the church, by and large, the Roman Catholic Church, is one of authority and magisterium and teaching. As even though many of its individual members are more flexible, the church, by and large, tends to be a teaching body.
But other than Catholic folks have the same problem of feeling terror when it comes to making a decision that really is giving themselves permission to be free. Breaking a bad habit of any sort, liking oneself and testing oneself out in a new relationship, those are terrifying moments, and many times the reason one has not done them is because one has been held under a guilty mm-hmm. sense of what that means, which has been reinforced by religious training. And it makes you not want to choose freedom. Better that I be guilty and really think of myself as a lousy person, which is familiar. I live with it every day, at least. There's
well,
too much uncertainty out
the whole
there
thing,
in freedom.
If we have people who are well-educated and have experienced a lot in life, but as far as their spiritual and emotional status is concerned, they're still children. They only remember what they learned in their catechism, even though they may have a doctorate in something else.
Okay, well, let's get to the phones now. We do have a number of people waiting. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that it seems to me that when the Christian church was started, that the Christian church itself must have been something very much like a cult. It was a small group of people with radical, heretical ideas. And I'm not sure that it's all that much different now. You're making a distinction between humanitarian and authoritarian. But when you talk about humanitarian, you're straying from all religious doctrine that's being taught in the world, certainly in the Christian
okay,
or Jewish faith.
Let me have my guest respond to that.
I haven't spoken about the cult business because I think that it has been misconstrued. I would agree with the caller that most of what we now know as major world religions began in some sense as a cult. That's a creative thing. That's a group of people gathering around to conserve a central idea, a central meaning, and then forming some rites and some structures by which that those stories can be preserved and passed on to further generations. And inevitably, they incur the wrath of the outside world because they're a minority group. And therefore, there's persecution and there's martyrdom and so forth. It's mm-hmm. a Jewish story. It's a Christian story. It's true a lot. What is very, very different, I think, I'm safe in saying, is that those were emerging processes in which authoritarian figures did not play the major roles. Those were community events.
Mm-hmm.
Those were movements of groups of people that were interrelated, and the stories themselves, the sacred documents which have been preserved, and this is true of the Eastern religions as well as the Western ones, show conflict, they show dialogue, they show difference of mm-hmm. opinion, and they continue to show an open-endedness to the way the cult finally emerges.
And also major aberrations.
Yes.
You know, of which we would consider Jonestown perhaps one of them.
I mean, yes,
the early church heresies, which were not just doctrinal in nature, but they were mass suicides among early Christians because they couldn't get martyred, so they all jumped off cliffs together. And I mean, so there are certainly aberrations throughout history. We can look upon the Crusades and some of the atrocities of the Inquisition as aberrations of teachings that most of us would consider gentle, but yet how the heck have they done that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you for calling. So you see the history of religions as being very different from cults, but things like the Jonestown aberration happening within those religions. So what we saw at Germantown isn't a new phenomenon.
Well,
it's something that's been repeated through history.
Cult, the word cult is basic to the most creative words we have, culture, cultivate. Mm-hmm. That has to do with how to deal positively with something we've discovered that has meaning in a group. So we create some mythologies and some symbols and we pass it on.
Yeah, the more contemporary term that we're using now deals more with a circumscribed group under a powerful figure with very little freedom for anyone to do anything else. And there's the limitation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take another phone call. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I would like to say that I think maybe one of the most important questions that we as a society can ask ourselves is, what can we as a society learn from the Jonestown experience?
That's a good question.
I go back to my earlier remark and pick up on that. I think it's an excellent question. From my point of view, the most important thing to be learned is that the first order of business for a person who wants to be a healthy, creative human being is to develop a tolerance for ambiguity. Putting it into simple phrase, which I learned from a teacher myself, the great Paul Tillich, the theologian, created that phrase. I think that that's what is really basic now to the agenda of the human race, that all of our religious, philosophical, political, and ethical, and moral traditions have some creative input into that process, and that rather than reinforce those things which try to make certain absolutes and exclusive claims, that the first order of business is to break down those barriers and get into the more global understanding of human existence. And I don't believe, see, that's what I think we can learn from such an aberration as the Jonestown thing.
And I'd like to add to that, that we have to start off with a good, healthy concept of self, so we don't have to run off after false teachers. And that's hard to do. I mean, and because so much of that is determined genetically, economically, politically, that we can end up with people who just don't know who they are and can really get sucked in sometimes. Because once you get in, it's really hard to get out, as we can see.
I think we have to understand that...
I'm going to ask you to keep it very brief so we could get to some other callers.
Yes. People from different segments of our society, of course, have greatly different perspectives on everything. And I'm sorry, my train of thought flew out of my head when you asked me to hurry up. I'll just cut it off there. And
okay, then.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Thanks for calling. It was a good question. Bye-bye. Just picking up on, before we get to the next phone call, what you were starting to say, that people who have no sense of self are susceptible to cults. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's one of the things...
Yeah, I think
one of the things that you get when, maybe I should stop using the word cult after what you were saying, Ralph, but
yeah.
Okay, but I guess what I want to ask you is, what are some of the things in it for a follower, for someone who joins Jonestown
okay.
or whichever
sure.
group?
Well, if you start off at a very elementary level, Harvey Cox's study at Harvard a couple of years ago talked about when he went around interviewing young people who were in cults up in the Boston area and nationally, that one of the first things they're looking for is friendship, belonging to a group. Feeling a part of something. And we know this very good example from the drug culture, for example. And that belonging, feeling a part, being able to identify. Also, a secondary thing which is very important is authority. How one sees authority frequently will determine what kind of religious organization one gets into. And for many people in Jonestown, they were looking for almost someone to become their conscience for them. At least it ended up that way.
I see those two things really playing very closely together. That is, a positive self-image, the growth toward a positive self-image, dispels the need for exterior authority. One senses authority within oneself. So those things really play hand in glove. And I found that to be true with the young people still right now who work on the campus, either in conservative religious groups or authoritarian left-wing political groups. The need is met, either exterior authority, internal sense of loss of self, having to...
And if you remember that, at least from psychological theory, particularly in adolescence, there is almost a need to become more rigorous with oneself. Why do you think the Marines can attract people? The harder, the better.
Be a real man.
That's right. We'll take a few.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get back to the telephones. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I I just have a comment and a short question. I am the parent of a follower of the Way International, and I was chilled by the comparison between Victor Weirwill's speeches that I've heard on tapes and Jim Jones's. Now, this cult is a very paramilitary organization that teaches gun training, and they have weapons caches, and I was wondering how your guests feel about the possibility of another Jonestown occurring with this type of cult.
You want to take that, Ralph?
Yes, I have some knowledge of the Way, and I think the caller is correct. And I think that those people who are doing what they can as parents or others concerned to explore what are the legal, moral, health, political, other problems raised by these organizations which have First Amendment rights, which are nonprofit religious institutions and so forth, those efforts should be maintained. I think it's a terribly conflicted and painful situation that people such as the caller are in, who have a loved one who is often in that kind of a situation. And I don't think that within the free society that we have, there is an easy way to move in on this kind of situation without being extremely strong in orienting ourselves about the motivation that we have. Very often, anti-cult work tends to be almost as ruthless as the cults themselves. I have found that to be among some of the parent groups and some of the lawyer groups and the deprogramming groups. For me, it's a very painful situation in which folks of the American Civil Liberties Union background on the legal part of it, people from the broadest base of philosophical and religious traditions, people working with educational systems, business community, and some other people have got to have more input. We don't have mechanisms right now by which to deal with it. So she's putting her finger on a point which needs to be focused on by anyone interested in this crisis, because that's a very good example. A Jonestown thing is quite possible out of that one. A couple of others that I can think of, too.
Okay, thanks very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Terry. I listened to the program last night, and I was disappointed then, and I'm a little disappointed now, that the panel, and I think your guests today also, have dwelt so heavily on the religious and psychological aspects of Jonestown, almost to the exclusion of the social and political implications, which I think are much more significant in terms of understanding and learning from this tragedy, why it happened. For instance, we all recognize that the people who were and are attracted to this type of cult, to Jim Jones and the People's Temple, were, for the most part, I think we can agree, they were the disillusioned, alienated, and from the tape, I would guess, downright desperate, who I would call victims of our system, and who then are so vulnerable to this kind of demagoguery that Jones spouted. You know, his frequent use of the term socialism and Marxism was pure demagoguery because he had absolutely no understanding of those terms in the scientific sense, and he was just using them to appeal to these people's desire for some kind of social and economic equality to fill the gap that the system has left in their lives. Actually, Jonestown had nothing to do with socialism, never could have, you know. But I think the main thing to learn from this is that it wasn't his charismatic character or that of any particular cultist figure that's really to blame for this kind of thing, but the alienation that these people exploit and the system that breeds it. So I would like to hear some comment about this aspect of Jonestown, because I think as bizarre as it was, given the breakdown,
okay, can you sum it up, because we want to get to a lot of people.
I don't think we've seen the end of Jonestown.
Okay, thank
you.
Why don't you comment on that? And Julian, I'd also be interested in hearing how you react to what you're saying in the light of that a lot of cults are also middle-class kids.
That's it. I was thinking, as the caller was speaking, that my understanding of Jonestown is and cults in general, it cuts across all areas, in which case we could say then that all society is a problem. I think if we distill it back down to the individual and his or her family, living within a culture, within a society. We're still back to the individual person, and I don't know if certain social welfare reforms, etc., would change it. There's always going to be some people who are disaffected and become involved.
Congressman Ryan's daughter is involved with Scientology, which, mm-hmm. depending on where you are, you would group with this kind mm-hmm. of thing.
See, the thing is, there's many socially acceptable ways to go into organizations. We get upset with cults because of their exclusivity and their violation of people's rights, perhaps. We don't get upset as much with socially acceptable situations, military, other religious organizations, organized church. My goodness, I spent years in the Benedictine monastery. Let me tell you, it was at the tail end of the Middle Ages. All right, I did it freely. It was an incredible experience. I don't know too many people who can have that kind of experience. But then again, an awful lot of voluntary giving up of one's rights went on. But yet it was socially acceptable, for the most part, by society because it's an organized situation that's been around so long.
But it's a kind of ancient custom in a way, isn't it, that mm-hmm. that one of the many roads towards, like, spiritual truth is to give up all material possessions
yes.
and to sacrifice and to
yes,
to be very
the,
disciplined in
right,
that regard.
Right, but the key ingredient would be something that Ralph mentioned before. There's some freedom there. You're free to stay, free to lose, leave. Boy, that's a good slip. Ralph, you can pick up on that before I diagnose myself.
Right? Well, I wanted to reassure the caller that the political and the economic aspects of this are certainly as much a concern to me as religious and psychological. I didn't want to go too strongly in our response to the tapes along some personal feelings I have that she might have desired. For example, I think one really can analyze this kind of aberration from the standpoint of the failure of the consumer society and the failure of institutions built upon laissez-faire capitalism, the system itself, and that as long as there's a widening gap, as there now seems that we're in for a while, between the rich and the poor, and that the corporate structure is out to have a free rein now given to it with government assent, and that things are being cut back at the level of basic needs, and the poor themselves are being carved up between the most truly needy and so forth. I think we're in for a lot more very, very socially unacceptable outbreak of protest, rebellion, and rage, which from any standpoint that I can think of, religious or philosophical, is justified. And so from one standpoint, I have to say that I have to accept Jonestown
as a
statement of something along those lines.
Well, I think we can understand it, but I don't think we have to excuse it.
I'm not excusing, but I could say, no. I don't want my house burned down either.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to see the city of Philadelphia burned down. I don't want to see there be racial strife. There are most things I don't want to have to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, from in all sense of what justice demands, I think we're there. Really.
I think we don't want to miss the point, though, that Jonestown was one man who apparently, from the tapes that we've heard, was psychotic at the end, and much of what he did was because of that psychosis, as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we can speculate that if he didn't have that end up in that condition, things may have been different. There have been many social experiments of people going off into the woods, becoming enlightened in their own way, returning back to society freely. And in Eastern religions, it's done all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. No. I didn't want to get into the point where we're somehow justifying it. But I understand something of the intent of the caller along those
sure,
lines.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, let me reintroduce you. We're talking about Jonestown, and this discussion is based on the experience of having listened to the Jonestown tapes that were initially broadcast last night through the National Public Radio documentary. And I should mention that that documentary is available on cassette, and there was a phone number given last night, and I'll give that again. It's 800-253-0808 if you'd like a cassette copy, and there's a fee of $16. You can find out more information if you call the number. It's 800-253-0808. With me, talking about the Jonestown tapes, are Reverend Ralph Moore, the director of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus, and Dr. Julian Slavinsky, who is a clinical psychologist and was formerly a Benedictine monk and a theologian. And we're inviting phone calls here at WUHY. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine.
I have three questions and one statement, then I'll hang up and listen to your answers. One of my questions is the significance to the Russian flavor of the music last night, if they, one of the gentlemen there or yourself picked it up. The second question is, how was he able to get the lawyers and the nurses and the upper-middle-class individuals into it? The third question is, how did the federal government let it get away as far as it did as compared to the Black Panther Party, the Weathermen, so forth and so on? And the statement that I would like to make is comparing the Jonestown to the American school system today, you find that he related to more blacks than he did to white, because the blacks there seem to be very uneducated and very uninformed. And if someone can enlighten me on that, I'll hang up and listen to the answers, all right?
Thanks for your questions. Bye-bye.
Well, I can't respond to the Russian music. In terms of...
Maybe I should have a crack at that. I really don't see a Russian flavor to the music at all myself.
Okay. One thing that struck me as I was listening last night was, yes, here was a lawyer. There was a doctor available on site there. And being involved in Jonestown, let's remember again that basically they're people with their own needs.
I've often wondered how some of the greatest scientists and intellectuals of Western civilization could create the Third Reich and build, you know, engineer an entire death machine, and how we today can continue to base the future of the world upon the intelligentsia of a technological machine which is based on mass death, which has gotten the approval of even the electorate, because somehow that seems to be the, quote, civilized, end quote, way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
So just because there are labels of credentials of academic or professional standards from even great universities, by no means makes the world safe for sanity. So I think the caller is picking up on a strand of that, which is general.
Mm-hmm.
In world history, and certainly still true.
Do you want to touch his question about why the government didn't know more or do more?
Well, up until the end, the only familiarity I have, these people were supposedly a church, as Ralph mentioned before, worshiping in private, and they weren't breaking any laws at that point. Is that true, Ralph? Your understanding of it?
There was some information on the documentary which kind of has escaped me a bit, but it doesn't seem to me that the U.S. government had much relationship to the situation until people began to make inquiries, and finally the congressman himself pushed it hard. There was, and then of course the one member did break away and take the first real witness evidence to the embassy in Guyana.
And the argument can be made because of people who are frequently disadvantaged that the government waived.
I wish I knew more about that. That may be something that should be analyzed much more carefully in the future, because the caller is undoubtedly has some assumptions about that, the answer to that question too, which I think are important.
Okay, well, why don't we take another phone call? Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Well, I really felt like you did, Terry, when you were mentioning the way you thought Jim Jones sounded like a grade school teacher.
I don't want anyone to take offense at that. I meant that I had one or two I felt a certain resonance with what he was doing.
Exactly. That's what I felt. And I was disappointed that no one picked up on that. But I think the whole structure is similar, too. It wasn't just the tone of voice or the attitude, but the whole setup. You know, do what I tell you and you will succeed. Don't and you'll fail.
You want to pick up on that, Ralph?
I'm thankful for this connection. Not about a year or so ago, Estelle Parsons starred in a play, a one-woman play called Miss Margarita's Way, in which, what, an eighth-grade teacher, was it?
I don't remember the grade.
She held you spellbound the entire evening as a one-person show, acting, creating the audience as the eighth graders, or seven, maybe a little younger.
Oh, there's a British comic who does that, too.
Well, the interesting thing about Miss Margarita's Way, it was written by an exile from Argentina, and it became for him then an allegory for the for the totalitarian repression. Thank you so much for making that connection.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I heard your tape last night, and I just want to make a comment about Jim Jones.
Yeah.
It seems to me he was a top leading with old people and young kids, and to me that it seems like he had a selective audience. If he had an age group that ran the gamut with an equal proportion of people, I don't think he would have pulled it off. As I'm saying, I brought up in a culture where if you was on the ship and the ship was sinking, they said ladies and children first. Well, he did the opposite to what we was taught in this culture. He exploited the innocent, the old people and the young people.
Any comments?
Well, I don't know what he did with the others, but you could see the significance of the younger people and the older people are swept up through his manipulation. The rest have an investment in going along, particularly at the death scene of going along. My children are dying, the older people are dying, you know, I've got to join them.
Well, how many people that made up that middle group?
I don't know. I don't know what the statistics were.
I think he knew. That's why he didn't have no rebellion. But if he just had an audience that ran the gamut, he would have never pulled that off.
I'm not totally convinced that this is true, because we did hear this very ugly example of a person that sounded like a man in his 30s who was an intellectual being cracked, broken down. So it was clear that there were dissenters and rebellious people, and they had a very swift and sure way to deal with them quite instantly, to break them down.
Thank you for your phone call. Bye-bye. One of the things his question raises, I recently interviewed the author of a book called The Children of Jonestown. Mm-hmm. And what he said was that Jones used the children to have control over the children's parents.
Back to the Third Reich. Sounds very much like that.
And one of the questions that I think has to be asked, and I want to make sure we have enough time to get to it before the program ends, is what do you think are some of the things he did to create the kind of environment that would enable parents to say, I'll kill my son or daughter if you tell me to?
Well, it's so hard to imagine that I'm just answering out of
objection
of theory, I guess.
If we go back to the thing of the people identifying with him in the first place, being very idealistic, having him embodying the ideals. As things start to change, the people started to perhaps deny that this was really happening. Look at any family with a problem today. Dad's drinking too much. Well, he must have had a hard day at the office. Or mom's a little touchy today. She must have had a difficult day at work as well in managing the house, etc. There's a sense of denial going on there. Also a sense of rationalization as things start changing. You talk yourself out of it. By the time the people got so wrapped up in identifying with him, as the woman there said, I never heard a man like you before, the self becomes so wrapped up in him that the people perhaps could not handle turning against him and rather felt guilty about themselves, just as children frequently do when they're thinking of rebelling against their parents, at least in earlier years, end up feeling guilty about it. And I think if we go back to the individual person and what's going on in them, it might be easier to understand the group.
Is it fair to talk about Solomon in this context?
Solomon?
King Solomon, dividing the child?
Yeah. Or? Yeah.
Sure, that's fair. Yeah. Because you have there a normal situation where Solomon's is pushing a category of real filial love, real maternal love.
I think I've got the wrong person too.
No.
Is it
Abraham and Isaac.
Abraham, thank you. That's what I really meant.
Yeah, but here's the thing. In the Bible, if you love me and I'm your God, don't ask any questions, kill your son, anything you want, Lord. Even this I'll give you, looking at the Old Testament story. And then his faith was tested and God stayed his hand and said no. And Jones is saying, you know, if you believe in me, you know, this is what you have to do. And there's plenty of precedent for that. Even the thing that was mentioned last night, the Masada episode.
So if you're in the middle of something, how do you tell if it's crazy or not? Because...
well, I think this is
easy
where
for us to
the,
say
the,
that
the,
it's
never
it's
underestimate
crazy.
The power of denial.
And if there's any possibility of finding your way to just the one other person who's different enough from you whom you can trust... to try out your vision of reality.
And, of course, it was difficult to trust anyone under those circumstances.
Well, that's it. That's I was just trying to play that scenario out with my children and remembered the guy who said that he would not kill his daughter, and then they talked him into it.
Sure.
Right there. And it had to do because he was terrified to the point that he could almost see them coming down the road with guns, and therefore, if he didn't kill her, they would get her.
Sure, and the group absolved him from his guilt. They gave him permission.
There was the mass absolution.
That's right. It's okay. If you have any doubts, it's okay, and they appeal to the other side of his ambivalence.
Well, there you are with the Isaac and Abraham thing, because there the faith was tested not because he went through with it, but because his intention grew to a point. And there was kind of a suspension of anything that sanity or real religion
and
would convince
you. If it's culturally prescribed, as we know, sacrifices in different religions throughout history, then it's okay.
Ah, sacrifice. That was a word we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we're running so close on time. Let me ask you which of these is more important to discuss in the remaining couple of minutes, the notion of sacrifice, or like, should we do something? Should there be legislation that defines what a bad group is and what a good group is? Well, a lot of people are clamoring for legislation. Do you think it would be a good idea to have some kind of legislation that distinguishes... what?
As long as people's rights take precedence over people's needs, it's hard to get anything done, I think. And
it seems to me that people of responsiveness about human life and values need really to start with self, family, connections, institutions. And we've got our hands full right along those lines. Our agendas are very full. Our school system is a crisis in a city such as Philadelphia. Right there. I mean, if you want to respond to Jonestown creatively, work on the school system would be one way to respond to it. I don't think special legislation, special campaigns, special crusades is the response to Jonestown. Working within the fabric of the culture itself to respond to those needs which are not being met, which give rise to this sickness.
And that's always been our task. And this just reminds us once again of how far things can go.
Well, on that note, I think we'll have to end the show because we are out of time. I really enjoyed this discussion and found it really useful, and I want to thank you both very much for, I think, adding a lot to the questions raised by the Jonestown tapes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
We suspected that your callers would be top-notch, and they turned out once again to be
yes.
Good.
With me has been Reverend Ralph Moore, the director of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania, who's joined us a number of times in the past to talk about religious questions and ethical questions. Also with me has been Dr. Julian Slavinsky, who is a psychologist and was a monk in the 1960s and is a theologian as well. Thanks to all of our callers. My apologies for those of you who we didn't have time to talk with, but thank you for calling in. If you missed the documentary and you'd like to hear it, or if you'd like a copy of it, there are cassette copies available through National Public Radio, and you can call 800-253-0808 for information about how to get a cassette copy. Again, that's 1-800-253-0808. The documentary that we excerpted all earlier today was produced for National Public Radio. We'll be joining, all things considered, in just a few seconds. Maeve McGoran has been the associate producer today, filling in for Danny Miller, who had the day off. My name is Terry Gross, and I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a good weekend. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and we are a listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered. used to go to work late at 9. Now people go to work at around 11. Now they used to go back home at around 4, leaving early. Now they are coming back home at around 1. You see, you can see as if you are, it's a kind of business closing down.
Uganda. After Idi Amin, more trouble, and after that, even more trouble. Tonight on All Things Considered, the decline and almost total devastation of an East African land once thought to be paradise.
Also these stories, President Reagan lifts the grain embargo against the Soviet Union. He says it didn't work, and the Soviets will not see this as American weakness.
Reaction from the farmers, and a tough anti-Soviet speech from Secretary of State Alexander Haig.
The first round in the French presidential election coming up Sunday.
Senate hearings on international terrorism.
The widows of coal miners are organizing, demanding better benefits.
In Boston, a new treatment for a serious birth defect.
More from Hal Holbrook on the risks of being an actor.
And a new movie that's an old movie, but shorter this time around.
That and more tonight on All Things Considered. First, we have this hour's news from Richard Harris.
More than 15 months after President Carter imposed a grain embargo against the Soviets, President Reagan today lifted the ban on corn and wheat sales. But in doing so, he served notice the United States will react strongly to acts of aggression wherever they take place. The embargo was designed to punish the Soviets for invading Afghanistan, and Mr. Reagan said the decision to lift the ban on grain sales was delayed out of concern the Soviets might mistakenly think it indicated weakening of our position. As a presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan pledged to lift the embargo, saying it put an unfair burden on America's farmers. And he said his decision today came only after weighing all options and conferring with advisors and allies. Most economists and farmers agree the embargo didn't have a big impact on American agriculture, but Kansas wheat farmers are glad the embargo is over. Here's Ralph Titus of member station KSAC.
Kansas grows a lot of wheat, and because of that, the grain embargo has been a burr under the saddles of Kansas wheat farmers. They generally went along with it at first, but as it continued, they felt the burden was not being shared equally, and the embargo was clearly a political issue in November. So today's action was generally greeted with cheers by Kansas farmers. The president of the Kansas Farm Bureau, John Junior Armstrong, got the news in China, where he's on a trade mission. He called it very good news indeed.
It's something that we've been asking for and working for some time, and I'm very pleased that the administration now has seen fit to make the move.
The president of the Kansas Farmers Union, Ivan Wyatt, called it a positive action, but he was less enthusiastic, says it won't have much to do with the price of wheat.
I think there's been so much talk about lifting embargo for so long that the psychological benefit far as raising the market has probably been lost.
For National Public Radio, this is Ralph Titus in Manhattan, Kansas.
The Soviet news agency TASS said tonight the grain embargo had damaged American credibility as a reliable trading partner. In its report that the embargo would be lifted, TASS agreed with President Reagan that American farmers were hurt more than the Soviet Union. The decision to lift the embargo was made over the objections of Secretary of State Alexander Haig, who used tough language again today in accusing the Soviet Union of supporting terrorism. In a speech to newspaper editors in Washington, the general called Soviet promotion of violence the greatest danger to world peace, and he said the U.S. must strengthen its economy and military to meet Moscow's challenge. A Senate subcommittee opened hearings on terrorism this morning. Alabama Republican Jeremiah Denton agrees with Haig that the U.S. must take the bull by the horns.
If we continue to ignore the threat or define it away by academic gymnastics, the sand in which we bury our heads will eventually bury our nation.
The first witness at today's hearing was former CIA Director William Colby. He also charged that the Soviets are responsible for a great deal of international terrorism.
They have directly trained and supplied elements around the world engaged in what they euphemistically call wars of national liberation. They have employed their proxies and surrogates of Cubans, East Germans, Czechs, and others to extend this direct effort aimed not only at the imperialism of America and its allies, but at a variety of less despotic states than their own, from Mexico to Uruguay to Colombia to North Yemen to Morocco to Puerto Rico.
Colby said many terrorist groups may not be directed from Moscow, but the Soviets are responsible for training them and providing encouragement. Outside the Senate office building, there was picketing. The Liberal Americans for Democratic Action called the hearings inappropriate, comparing the proceedings to the defunct House Committee on Un-American Activities and hearings by the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. The FBI and Atlanta police have interviewed the man civil rights leader Roy Innes says is linked to the city's child murders. The authorities have concluded he is not. The man was not named to protect his reputation. Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner Lee Brown says he believes Innes was sincere in his story, which Brown called sincerely not true.
We appreciate the fact that many people have beliefs and theories about the cases, but those theories, those beliefs, are best handled by law enforcement without public fanfare.
Innes says he still considers his suspect the key link to break the case, and we will not back off one inch, he said. Meantime, another young black man has disappeared. 21-year-old Jimmy Payne is physically small, like three of the last four murder victims in Atlanta. The 10th District Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the government today and blocked the release of a jailed Cuban refugee who had been ordered freed yesterday by a federal judge. Today's ruling to stay the order releasing Pedro Rodriguez was made without comment, and oral arguments will be held the week of May 11th. Rodriguez and some 1,500 other Cubans who came to the U.S. aboard that Freedom Flotilla were jailed in this country because of their criminal records in Cuba. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials up 10 points. I'm Richard Harris in Washington.
In January 1980, Jimmy Carter placed a partial embargo on the sale of American grain to the Soviet Union, an effort to punish the Russians for invading Afghanistan. During the presidential campaign, Ronald Reagan vowed he would lift that embargo if elected. Today, after more than 3 months